Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Bill Brown and I will be reading Positively Speaking here on Sight Into Sound Radio. We are nearing the end of the book Seeing Home, the Ed Lucas Story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles by Ed Lucas and Christopher Lucas. Ed Lucas has told the story about he was blinded at age 12. He's gone through life quite well. He's been a sports broadcaster. He's interviewed many famous baseball players, and he's conducted his life in exemplary fashion. He got custody of his two boys after his wife had divorced him, and he's raised those two boys in a great fashion. Let's pick it up with Chapter 10, Does Home Plate Look Like a Dinner Plate? Chris wrote a letter to Mr. Steinbrenner in October 1980. He expressed his thanks to the boss for all of the support that he, the Yankees, and others had given to our family over the years, especially during the trial. I knew that my son was writing to George. What I didn't know was that he'd included a special request in the letter. The boys had heard the story of my accident thousands of times. They had also heard how their grandmother, along with the Giants, Dodgers, and Yankees, helped to pull me out of my deep depression. Chris remembered me saying that my dream as a boy was to throw out the first pitch in an important game. He wanted that dream to come true. In his letter, Chris asked Mr. Steinbrenner to think of me when he was making selections for ceremonial first pitch honors at Yankee Stadium. George sent a very nice reply, promising to put me on the list when the Yankees reached the World Series. They missed out in 1980, but did return to the Fall Classic the following season. The Yankees would be playing their old rival, the Dodgers, in the 1981 World Series. It would be their third championship match with Los Angeles in 5 years. A few days before the series began, George's PR director called me. I had made the list. The plan that Mr. Steinbrenner laid out was for Hollywood legend Jimmy Cagney to throw out the first pitch before the first game. Cagney's most famous role was as George M. Cohan in the classic 1941 film Yankee Doodle Dandy. He won an Academy Award for the part. The guy was a living legend, a New Yorker through and through, and a true Yankee. The second game was to feature Mr. Rizzuto, who had been the 1951 World Series MVP versus the Dodgers. I would be throwing out the pitch alongside him to honor the 30-year anniversary of his MVP award and the unique friendship we developed starting that year. The Yankees would then go on the road to Dodger Stadium for Games 3, 4, and 5. Game 6 honors would go to Joe DiMaggio, who was celebrating the 40th anniversary of his 56-game hitting streak. Game 7's ceremonial first pitch would be handled by Don Larsen. 25 years earlier, Larsen pitched the only perfect game in World Series history. That also happened against the Dodgers. I was excited. Chris was even more thrilled. One of my childhood dreams was about to come true in front of millions, thanks to my son. Then the commissioner stepped in to alter the plans. Bowie Kuhn, baseball's head honcho, gave an order that no celebrities or politicians were allowed to throw out World Series first pitches. It had to be someone connected to baseball. I made the cut, but Jimmy Cagney did not. George was forced to rescind the invitation to the silver screen icon. After a mad scramble, Joe DiMaggio agreed to move up his appearance to Game 1. There was immediate outrage from Jimmy Cagney fans throughout the world. How could he be humiliated like that? To prevent an international black eye for baseball, Commissioner Kuhn reversed the order. Good news for Cagney, bad news for me. Rizzuto and I were bumped from Game 2 so that the Oscar-winning actor could throw out the pitch without having to wait another week. Don Larsen moved his game up from 7 to 6. Scooter and I were then rescheduled to throw out the first pitch at Game 7. Sadly, that game never happened. The Yankees lost to the Dodgers in 6, giving L.A. the championship. I saw Mr. Steinbrenner after the game. His team had just been defeated, but all he was worried about was that my feelings would be hurt. George apologized profusely and asked me to say sorry to Chris for him. I appreciated that. He told me that I'd be at the top of the list the next time the Yankees got to the World Series. They didn't return for another 15 years. George also asked me what charities I supported. I named a few, like the Seeing Eye and Holy Family. Over the years, he quietly sent large checks to all of them. That was the type of man George Steinbrenner was. He was a kind soul. He never hesitated to help those in need or to donate to good causes. I deeply admired him for that, and I tried to emulate his philanthropic spirit. Shortly after that, Holy Family hired a new administrator. I'd kept in touch with Sister Anthony Marie and the nuns who shaped my life, but times were changing by the early 1980s. Most school districts were assimilating blind students, which was amazing progress. It spelled doom for schools like Holy Family, which were dedicated solely to helping the blind. In an effort to keep afloat, the nuns welcomed students with other major disabilities. The increased workload was proving too much for the sisters to handle, so they turned to lay teachers and administrators. Herb Miller was a born leader. As soon as he took the job as administrator at Holy Family, he put into motion a plan for the school that went beyond the walls of the building. He became a passionate advocate for the blind. Herb and his wife, Xenia, loved the students as if they were their own children. Herb wasn't shy about mingling with politicians and business people to gain needed support for the school and help create new laws making life easier for the disabled. He was already doing that on a local level, but wanted to broaden his horizons. He reached out to me for help. Other than the occasional fundraising drive and speeches to Lions clubs around New Jersey, I hadn't done much directly for my alma mater. Herb asked if I would give him a hand in promoting the school and his mission. I leaped at the chance. I wasn't officially an employee of Holy Family, but I became Herb's teammate. It was the start of a productive partnership. My list of guides was pretty long. I had no shortage of volunteers to take me to games. Even so, Herb became my most frequent companion, followed closely by Gene Mell and Bob Deal. The Yankees of the 1980s were a fun group, though a little tamer than the Bronx Zoo 1970s crew. Sparky, Reggie, and Goose were gone by then. There were a few holdovers. Willie Randolph, Ron Guidry, and Greg Nettles were among the last links to the championship teams. All three would be named Yankee captains. Two young guys, first baseman Don Mattingly and pitcher Dave Rigetti, made an immediate impact and became close friends. Mattingly started joking with me almost from the first day he arrived. He would tease me about everything from my escorts and wardrobe to the size of the microphones and recorders I used. I played right along with him and even pulled some pranks of my own. I was standing with Herb Miller at Yankee outfielder Dave Winfield's locker, interviewing the future Hall of Famer about an upcoming series with the Detroit Tigers, when Charlie, the clubhouse guard, came over to say, "You have about 10 minutes left before I have to close the locker room, Eddie." I checked my watch and said, "Got it, Charlie. I'll leave in 10. Mattingly happened to see me check the watch, missing the part where I flipped up the glass to feel the braille. He was astonished. Racing over from his locker, Don said, "Eddie, how the heck can you tell time with a wristwatch? You can't see that thing. It probably doesn't even work. Come on, you probably just wear it for show." I took the watch off and handed it to him so that he could see that it was functioning like any other timepiece. This frustrated Mattingly to no end. He could see the braille on the inside of the glass, but didn't realize there was a secret button to push to flip the glass up. He spent the next 3 minutes feeling the face on the watch again and again as several players looked on with curiosity. Finally, he gave up. Mattingly handed the watch back to me and said, "Eddie, I don't know how you do it, pal. You can feel those bumps through the glass, and I can't. That's amazing." "Well, Don," I replied with a grin, "some guys can hit curveballs, some can't. Some guys can feel braille through glass, some can't. We've both got our talents." As Herb walked me toward the door and away from Mattingly, I turned to him and called out, "Hey, Don." As soon as I had his attention, I held my wrist up, pushed the button and revealed the secret of the watch. Other players roared with laughter. I had to run out the door to avoid the barrage of towels the freshly pranked Mattingly good-naturedly tossed in my direction. You're listening to Positively Speaking on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Dave Righetti, like Ted Williams and several other players, loved seeing my dog. I would bring Flo with me whenever I could. Dave always took time to pet her. Flo was very well behaved in the clubhouse. One afternoon, she started jumping around and barking. This was totally uncharacteristic. It went completely against her training. I couldn't figure out what was spooking her until a few days later, when Greg Nettles shared with me that he'd brought a sonic dog whistle into the locker room and was blowing it to see what Flo would do. Only she could hear it. Players were actually pranking my dog. I don't think any other media members could say that. By the end of 1981, Flo began slowing down to the point where she had to retire. Once again, I was heartbroken, but knew that she would be happier on the farm. Another three-week trip to the Seeing Eye brought me together with my third dog, Bessie. She was a yellow lab and was definitely more active and alert than Kay or Flo had ever been. A few weeks after Bessie came home, she showed us just how remarkable she was. In December 1981, my sister Maureen gave birth to her third child, a daughter whom she named Erin Rose. Bessie loved the baby. Whenever Maureen came downstairs with Erin and my dog was off duty, Bessie would stay close to my infant niece. One Sunday evening in April 1982, we were all seated at the table for our weekly family dinner. Bessie was lying at my feet. Erin was in a bouncy seat that had rollers so that she could move around the room. Without warning, Bessie bolted from my side, raced over to Erin, and knocked her little bouncy seat a few feet backward. The baby started crying. As they ran to comfort Erin, my mother and sister yelled at me to scold Bessie for scaring the baby. Then they realized what actually happened. Someone had left the door to the basement slightly ajar. It was an opening small enough that nobody noticed it. Nobody except Bessie, that is. When my dog saw how close the baby was getting to the door, Bessie realized that one push by Erin's bouncer would open it, sending her forward into a dangerous tumble down the stairs. Bessie used her seeing eye training to take action and to save a child's life. My dog was a hero. Almost exactly a year later, Bessie would prove her heroism once again with an act of canine bravery and sacrifice that still brings me to tears. I was in the middle of my nightly 11 o'clock p.m. routine of walking Bessie when I heard an odd sound coming from down the street. I quickly identified it as that of a car scraping and smashing into other cars. Union Street had a tavern at the end of our block. Occasionally, patrons would drink too much and get behind the wheel. The Jersey City Police Department usually did a great job at stopping them. Tonight, one of the drunks got through their net. My brain processed the fact that a car was speeding out of control on a direct course toward me. I froze. I wanted to react, but my body was gripped by fear. Not Bessie. She recognized the danger as soon as I did. Before I knew what was happening, my dog ran in front of me and knocked me backward, just as she had done for my niece. I was safe. Bessie suffered for her heroism. Her leash was violently ripped from my hands as the car struck her head on. She was dragged 100 yards up the block. I sat on the ground in shock, screaming for help. My neighbors ran out of their homes to come to my aid. Unfortunately, the driver had escaped the scene and was never caught, leaving Bessie's crumpled and bloody body in the middle of Union Street. She was rushed to the emergency animal hospital, but it was too late. I held my brave and lovely partner in my arms as she breathed for the very last time. It took me a few months to return to the Seeing Eye for another dog. Several players expressed their condolences. Dave Righetti was especially kind. His career was in full bloom by then as the heir to great Yankee pitching legends. I told him that I thought he was next in line to throw a no-hitter, something no Yankee had done for a quarter century. He laughed at the notion. On July 4, 1983, I was at the Seeing Eye, listening on the radio as Righetti struck out Wade Boggs of the Red Sox to complete a no-hitter. I was thrilled for him, but felt bad that I couldn't be there to congratulate him in person. When I saw him at the stadium a few weeks later, accompanied by my new dog, a male black lab named Tommy, Dave gave me a ball inscribed, "To Eddie, you predicted it, Dave Righetti, 7-4-83. Then he whispered, "That's for Bessie." Holy Family had an annual fundraising variety show that was languishing by the time Herb Miller came along. He was always looking for new ideas to help the school or trying to revitalize old ones. This show would be a perfect project for us. The benefit gala had actually been started by my mentor, Jerry Malloy, in the 1950s. Jerry passed away in 1977, so it was an honor to follow in his giant footsteps. Just as I had done for the telethon a few years earlier, I reached out to celebrity friends to participate in the gala show to raise the profile. Ted Brown, a local radio legend from WNEW, presided over the show and would often arrange for singers and comedians to appear on the bill. Established names like singer Jerry Vale and up-and-coming talents like comedian Joy Behar all pitched in. Dolly and Marty Sinatra were big supporters of the school throughout their lives. They were both gone by then, but Herb thought it might be a good idea to honor them posthumously. We reached out to Frank Sinatra's representatives in California to let them know about our show and the tribute to his parents. To our amazement, we got word that old Blue Eyes himself was so touched by Holy Family's salute to his mother and father that he was going to drop by the benefit show to represent them and accept on their behalf. There were some conditions. Mr. Sinatra would not be performing, just making a short acceptance speech. He would only stay for about 30 minutes. We were not allowed to publicize his appearance at all. They were all fair requests. Herb and I were just excited that one of the biggest stars in the world would be on hand to speak to supporters of the school. I was as excited as I've been at almost any other time in my life. I'd be meeting my musical idol. I couldn't wait to share stories with him about how kind his parents were to me. We kept the secret pretty tight. Nobody knew about our special guest. The night before the show, I got an urgent phone call from California. Sammy Davis Jr. had died. Given that he was one of Mr. Sinatra's best friends, naturally, plans had changed. Funeral arrangements were being made in Los Angeles, and there was no way Sinatra could come to New Jersey for the show. Of course, we understood. Nevertheless, our benefit show was still a big hit. We made more money for Holy Family that year than any other. Herb and I wondered if we could schedule other events, perhaps even with Scooter's help. Mr. Rizzuto was one of the greatest advocates of charities for the blind, including Holy Family. Like Russ Hodges in San Francisco, Scooter would use much of his airtime to mention them, in between giving play-by-play and the score. He also donated 100% of his fees from speaking engagements and royalties from his books to the school and other worthy causes. Coupled with his long career as a broadcaster and player, this made Scooter one of the most beloved Yankees ever. The team knew what a treasure they had in Rizzuto. In 1985, they announced that Phil would receive their ultimate honor. His uniform number 10 would be retired, and a plaque featuring his likeness would be added on the wall in Monument Park, Yankee Stadium's fabled mini version of the Hall of Fame. The ceremony was set for Sunday, August 4th, before a game against the Chicago White Sox. John Fugazi, the director of special events and promotions for the Yankees, made a very special request of me. He wanted me to be the keynote speaker for Phil Rizzuto Day at the stadium. The speech would be made during the ceremony, in front of 57,000 fans and live on TV. I accepted without hesitation. This would be a chance for me to publicly thank Scooter for helping to change my life. I wanted the world to know what a terrific guy Mr. Rizzuto was. Fugazi was giving me the perfect opportunity to do so. I was asked to put together a 2.5-minute speech describing the unique friendship Mr. Rizzuto and I had developed over 34 years. The words came easy to me. I spent months paring them down to a streamlined talk that would fit into the time limit. When I finally had it at the 150-second mark, Fugazi called me again. He realized that WPIX, which would be televising the event to an audience of millions, wanted to add commercial breaks. To accommodate them, I needed to cut 30 seconds from my keynote address. The solution was simple. I'd originally planned to mention each of Phil's children by name. If I just omitted that part, since they would probably be mentioned by others anyway, I could shave off the extra time. It worked. I now had a neat and concise 2-minute talk. Bob Deal was my guide that afternoon. The stadium was completely sold out. Even the press box was jam-packed. I stood on the field before the game as several Yankee sponsors and teammates presented gifts to Phil, Cora, and their kids. The New York Daily News even gave him a live cow named Huckleberry. As Phil went to greet his new pet, the cow nudged him, promptly knocking him to the ground. Phil, showing the trademark humor that endeared him to his admirers, popped right back up with a huge grin on his face. 20 minutes into the ceremony, my name was called by MC Frank Messer, Phil's broadcast partner. Bob walked me up to the microphone at home plate. I took a deep breath. Home plate at Yankee Stadium is hallowed ground. This was the same spot on which Lou Gehrig made his famous "Luckiest Man on the Face of the Earth" speech in 1939. I was following in some huge footsteps. For a moment, I was overwhelmed by the task. After my initial nervousness disappeared, I began my 2-minute speech. I had the cadence and timing practiced to the second. I also made one big error. I hadn't factored in the feedback that comes from the public address system at cavernous Yankee Stadium. There is a natural delay of a second or two from the time you talk into the microphone until it comes out of the speakers. This causes a weird and jarring echo. Even experienced singers get thrown when they try to perform the national anthem from that spot. My timing was way off. I abandoned any hope of keeping to the allotted 2 minutes. Winging it was the best option. I had a feeling that I might be going over my time limit. Nobody was saying anything to me, so I figured it was okay. What I didn't know was that the WPIX camera crew was frantically waving at me to finish up. Unlike Howard Danzig, who realized that hand gestures wouldn't work for me on the stand, these guys had no clue as to how to signal me. I was unwittingly causing agitation for the director of the broadcast. Bob Deal finally put an end to it by walking over, tapping me, and quietly saying, "They want you to finish, Ed." The added minutes didn't ruin things after all. The pregame ceremony finished on time and without a hitch. Phil was delighted and humbled by the day's tributes. He and Cora took me aside to thank me for being a big part of it. I told them that there was no way I'd ever be able to repay all of the kindness and friendship they'd shown to me. A public speech in his honor was the least I could do. I owed my career and so much more to the Rizzutos. I now had a regular baseball column in the Jersey Journal called As I See It, and a monthly column in the official scorecard magazine of the Yankees, sold at the ballpark and on newsstands. 24-hour sports programming on cable TV and talk radio was in its infancy. They would call me on as a guest for local and national TV and radio shows. I enjoyed talking baseball with hosts like Art Rust Jr., Barry Farber, Ed Randall, Bill Daughtry, Spencer Ross, Richard Neer, and Ann Liguori on stations like Sports Channel, ESPN, WOR, WABC, and WFAN. WMCA Radio, AM 570, gave me a Saturday afternoon show of my own. I co-hosted it with Howie Carpen. Howie was a local guy who knew the rules of baseball inside and out. He now serves as official scorer for both the Yankees and Mets. During our show, Howie and I would take calls from fans, have guests like Mr. Rizzuto, Hall of Famers Richie Ashburn and Ralph Kiner, and play pre-recorded interviews. It was some of the most fun I've ever had covering the game. John Sterling also hosted a show on WMCA and would have me in to chat. He had an amazing voice and an almost encyclopedic knowledge of sports. In WMCA's overnight spot, they had an energetic kid, Chris Russo, fresh out of college. He was dubbed Mad Dog. Chris was a fellow Giants fan. He and I bonded right away. He was funny, a breath of fresh air in the sometimes stuffy sports world. I enjoyed his work and figured he'd get pretty far. Mad Dog now has his own channel on Sirius XM Radio and is one of the most famous broadcasters in the United States. John Sterling went on to become the esteemed voice of the Yankees for a whole new generation of fans. It couldn't have happened to two nicer guys. My friend Eddie Dunphy introduced me to Kevin Williams early in the 1980s. Kevin was the station manager at WOBM Radio in Toms River, New Jersey. He'd heard my interviews and hired me to cover baseball for the station, which had a large audience in the South Jersey area. I did that for almost 20 years. All-star pitcher Al Leiter, a Toms River native who came up with the Yankees and was a three-time World Series champion with the Toronto Blue Jays and Florida Marlins, once told me that he loved listening to me on WOBM when he was younger. In addition to the sports shows on traditional radio, I did work for two stations dedicated to blind listeners. One was called EIES of New Jersey. The other was In Touch Network. I would do interviews with the players like I did for WOBM and WMCA, but these had a different angle. The questions I asked dealt with things that sighted people take for granted. I would encourage the players to describe what it looked like to enter Yankee Stadium for the first time or to see a play develop. Some even described their uniforms. It sounds simplistic, but many radio hosts and broadcasters overlook things like that. Michael Kay, who is the face and voice of the Yankees Yes Network, is a notable exception. He takes special care to always describe home and visiting uniforms for blind listeners. One of Kay's most famous on-air phrases is his description of the Yankees' classic home uniform. They are wearing their crisp white jerseys with an interlocking NY and pinstripes and no name on the back, of course. I'd sometimes take questions from blind listeners on In Touch. They were very incisive. I didn't lose my sight until I was 12, so I had an image in my head of what a ballpark looked like. Anyone who was born blind had no sense of this. As a result, I was asked things like, is the foul pole thin like a fishing pole or thick like a flagpole? Is a dugout actually dug out of the dirt or like a little room on the field? Does home plate look like a dinner plate? I tried my best to answer them all, giving thanks to God that He was allowing me to share what I knew with other fans who couldn't actually see the game they loved. When I give banquet, corporate, and after-dinner speeches, the organizers sometimes want me to leave time for questions and answers. It's at these events that I've gotten some interesting inquiries from sighted people who are curious about what life is like for a blind person and broadcaster. Here are some of the most frequently asked. Are your other senses even stronger? Are you able to feel, taste, and hear things better than us? This is the biggest misconception about blind people. The comic book hero Daredevil has these powers, not me. The only thing that I can honestly say increased a bit after my accident was my sense of audio perception. It's what helps me to identify which direction baseballs are headed just by the crack of the bat. It also comes in handy when trying to differentiate voices. Some people say, I'm better with faces than names. I don't have that option. I can remember others only by their voice. We have come to the end of our program. I have been reading Seeing Home, the Ed Lucas Story, on Positively Speaking. I'm Bill Brown, and this has been a production of Sight Into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.